Welcome to the deep dive. You've shared some really fascinating material from Dr. Ted Hildebrandt, and we're going to use that today to explore a concept that, well, it might seem simple on the surface, the fear of God, but it's actually got some surprising depth. Our goal is really to unpack what that phrase meant, you know, in its original biblical context.
Right.
And we'll be using a pretty cool tool from cognitive linguistics to help us do that, metonymy.
That's right. And it's important because when you first hear fear of God, your mind probably jumps to one idea, maybe reverence or respect.
Yeah, usually respect.
But as we dig into this material, you'll see it's the much more dynamic concept. It really covers a whole spectrum.
Right.
Everything from this profound sense of awe, even, you know, terror in the face of the divine.
Right.
All the way to really practical things like moral behavior, obedience, wisdom. It's broad.
And that's where the linguistics comes in, right?
Yeah.
So cognitive linguistics, people might have heard of metaphor. That's when we understand one thing by comparing it to something else. Like, the Lord is my shepherd.
Exactly. That's a classic.
It helps us grasp something abstract, like God's care, by linking it to something more concrete, like a shepherd watching sheep.
Right. Metaphor bridges different conceptual areas. Shepherd, God, different categories. But today, we're really focusing on its cousin, metonymy.
Okay.
Think of metonymy as more of a mental shortcut within the same conceptual area, the same domain. It's when one word or idea that's like closely associated with another can stand in for it. It just triggers that other idea in our minds.
Okay. Yeah. So if I say the crown, you immediately think king or queen, right?
Perfect example.
The crown is part of that whole idea of kingship, so it easily brings kingship to mind. So that's the kind of linguistic relationship we're looking for with fear of God.
Precisely.
And it's really important to get this straight from the outset. We're not just talking about, you know, being polite to God or showing basic respect.
No, definitely not just that.
Because, as we'll see in the material, there are definitely times when fear of God points to a really intense, maybe even terrifying encounter with the holy. That idea sometimes called mysterium tremendum.
The sense of awe mixed with dread.
Yeah.
And one more quick thing, grammatically speaking.
Yeah.
When we see the phrase fear of God, it's typically what linguists call an objective genitive.
Okay. Objective genitive. What does that mean practically?
It basically just clarifies that the feeling of fear is directed towards God. God is the object of the fear.
Nah, I see.
It's not God being afraid or the fear belonging to God in that sense. It's our response to God that we're exploring.
Gotcha. That's a really helpful distinction. So it's about the human experience, the human response to the divine. Okay, let's maybe dig a little deeper into fear itself with some personal examples, make it a bit more concrete.
Good idea.
You know, thinking about fear, it reminds me of when my daughter was really small. We used to walk past this house, and they had this big dog behind a wire fence.
Oh, yeah.
And this wasn't like a friendly little pup. It was a big, imposing dog, and it would just charge the fence, barking like crazy. And she was genuinely terrified, like a really primal, instinctual fear of getting hurt.
Yeah, that's a vivid picture. That's fear as a pure survival mechanism, isn't it? That
yeah.
immediate reaction to danger. Fight or flight kicking in.
Totally. And it's funny, my own relationship with fear, specifically heights, has really changed over time.
Oh, how so?
Well, I used to be completely fine with heights. I mean, I remember painting the very peak of our two-story house way up on an extension ladder. We're talking, I don't know, maybe 40, 50 feet up.
Wow, okay.
And I just have one of my kids, you know, put a foot on the bottom of the ladder. Didn't bother me at all. Even when shingles blew off in storms, I'd be up there on our steep roof nailing them back down. As long as someone was holding the ladder, I felt fine.
Sounds like the confidence of youth, maybe. It's interesting how our perception of risk can shift, you know, as we get older or more aware.
Right. Exactly. Because then a few years ago, we had this really bad storm, tore off some shingles right at the very peak again. So I had to go up. But this time I had to literally straddle the peak of the roof to nail them back in. And it suddenly hit me. Nobody was holding the ladder. My kids were grown. My wife was at work. I was just up there. Alone. And the sheer drop with absolutely nothing below for the first time, I felt this real fear of heights, like a physical sensation.
I can imagine.
It was the same feeling I got later in Spain, actually. We were at this monastery, perched on a cliff, and there was just this, like, 2,000-foot sheer drop right in front of me. Suddenly, height wasn't just a number. It was this tangible, visceral sense of danger.
What's fascinating there is how your awareness changed, right? A shift in your consciousness of the risk led to this really powerful emotional response.
Yeah.
It shows fear isn't always innate. It can develop as we become more aware of potential consequences.
Precisely. And this relates back to Dr. Hildebrand's material, I think. Fear can be a good thing. It protects us, right? Keeps us careful around heights or away from charging dogs.
Mm-hmm. Serves a purpose.
But it can also be unhealthy. You know, irrational fears, phobias that limit us. And importantly, fear can be a motivator. It can make us change our behavior. That fear of heights definitely makes me think twice now.
Right. So how does this connect back to the fear of God?
Well, it brings us to the different ways that phrase is used. The source material you shared likely touches on a whole range of meanings. There's that fear of terror we mentioned, the mysterium tremendum, awe, trembling.
Yep.
But also its connection to moral conduct, following the law, covenant stuff.
Right, obedience.
And then there are cultic passages about worship, awe, reverence in that context.
Mm, worship practices.
Wisdom literature, where it's about virtue, character, fear of punishment, obviously.
That comes up too.
Humility, recognizing our creatureliness, just general piety, even keeping statutes, like observing laws. And remember those God-fearers, that term used for like moral foreigners.
Yeah, non-Israelites who respected God and lived ethically. It's a really wide net.
It is. And it's crucial to understand, like you said, these aren't just separate dictionary definitions added together.
No, definitely not. This is where that idea of metonymy becomes so key. It's not just a list.
Right. It's not like adding apples and oranges. It's more like, think back to your examples, scepter for king, or maybe a diligent hand standing for a diligent person.
Yeah. Or the mouth of the wicked for the wicked person themselves.
Exactly. Metonymy is this cognitive link where one concept, the vehicle, you called it.
Mm-hmm, the vehicle concept.
Provides a mental pathway, a trigger to another related concept, the target. And they're in the same general area of meaning.
That's the key distinction from metaphor. Metaphor crosses categories God and shepherd. Metonymy works within a category scepter and king are both related to royalty, hand and person, part and whole. And we use it constantly without even realizing it. Like saying, nice wheels for a car.
Right. Wheels for car, part for whole.
Or asking someone to make a Xerox instead of make a copy.
Brand name for the action.
Yeah.
Or saying, Washington decided something. When you mean the U.S. government.
Place for the institution. Got it.
Or even saying someone has a long face to mean they're sad.
Physical expression for the emotion. Okay, I'm seeing the pattern.
Yeah. Or think about how in some Jewish traditions, God is referred to as Hashem, which literally means the name.
Ah, so the name stands in for God himself.
Exactly. The name, vehicle, points directly to the divine being, target. It's a classic metonymy. Now, Dr. Hildebrand's teaching, based on the material you saw, likely points out a really clear biblical example of this with fear of God. It's the phrase, the fear of Isaac, in Genesis 31.
Oh, right. Genesis 31.42. Jacob is speaking, isn't he? He says, if the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side.
Exactly that verse. Now, the fear of Isaac there doesn't mean Isaac was like a scaredy cat.
No. Haha.
Instead, the profound reverence, that specific awesome relationship Isaac had with God that becomes the metonym. Fear, in this context, triggers the concept of God himself, the one Isaac feared and worshipped.
So the emotion associated with Isaac's relationship stands in for God. That's fascinating. And you mentioned some translations even capitalize fear there.
They do, yeah. Recognizing its functioning almost like a title or a name for God in that specific phrase, it really highlights the metonymic connection.
Okay, so Isaac's awe metonymically points to God. Now let's explore one of those specific meanings we listed earlier. That sacred fear, the mysterium tremendum.
Right, Rudolf Otto's concept.
Yeah. Can you unpack that a bit more? It sounds intense.
It is. Otto described it as this complex, overwhelming emotional experience when someone encounters the holy, the divine. It includes elements of, terror, trembling, dread.
Okay, scary stuff.
But it's mixed with this powerful sense of awe, majesty, fascination. It's being in the presence of something utterly different, powerful and holy. Think about maybe standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon or watching a massive thunderstorm roll in.
Yeah, you feel small.
Exactly. There's that feeling of being in the presence of something immense, way beyond your control, something that inspires both awe and maybe a little bit of healthy fear, a sense of your own smallness. Mysterium tremendum is that feeling, but directed towards God.
And the Bible is full of examples of this, isn't it?
Absolutely. Think about Moses at the burning bush in Exodus 3. It says he hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God.
Right. And the ground itself was holy ground, that connection between God's presence, holiness, and fear.
Exactly. Or Isaiah's vision in Isaiah 6. He sees the Lord on the throne, and his reaction is, woe is me, I am lost. He feels completely undone in God's presence.
It sounds like Mysterium Tremendum.
It really does. And think way back to Adam and Eve in Genesis 3. After they disobeyed, what do? They hid themselves from God's presence. Fear was part of that initial separation.
And even Moses, later in life, Stephen recounts in Acts 7 that Moses trembled and did not dare to look when recalling God's voice from the bush. That memory still evoked fear.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the huge scene at Mount Sinai in Exodus 20. This is maybe the clearest picture.
Oh, yeah, the giving of the Ten Commandments.
Right. You've got thunder, lightning, a loud trumpet blast, the mountain covered in smoke. And the text says the people saw this, and they trembled and stood far off. They were terrified.
They literally asked Moses to be the intermediary, didn't they? You speak to us, and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us, lest we die.
Exactly. They wanted distance from that overwhelming presence. But interestingly, Moses tells them, do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin.
So there's a twist. The terrifying experience is meant to instill a different kind of fear, one that leads to obedience, preventing sin.
Precisely. It's using that intense experience to cultivate a lasting sense of awe and respect for God's authority. We see a similar pattern, actually, around the Red Sea, crossing in Exodus 14.
How so?
Well, the chapter starts with the Israelites being terrified of the approaching Egyptians, but it ends, after God miraculously saves them, with the line, Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians, so the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses.
Oh, so it starts with fear of the enemy and ends with fear of God after witnessing his power. That's like a framing device, isn't it? An inclusio.
Exactly, an inclusio. The experience of God's mighty act transforms their fear. It leads to awe, belief, and reverence. Deuteronomy 5 echoes this too. After the Sinai experience, the people say the right things. They acknowledge God's greatness and their fear. And God says, he says, oh, that they had such a heart as this always, to fear me and keep all my commandments, that it might go well with them.
So God affirms their fearful response, but wants it channeled into ongoing obedience for their own good.
Right. And this thread of sacred fear, this awe and response to God's power and holiness, runs throughout the Old Testament. Isaiah 41 talks about the dismay and terror of God's enemies when he acts. Isaiah 8 actually tells people who to fear. Not human threats, but God himself. Let him be your fear and let him be your dread, connecting God's holiness directly with the response of fear.
Making a distinction between kinds of fear.
Yes. Jeremiah 10 asks rhetorically, who would not fear you, O King of the nations? Linking fear to God's kingship, his unique status as creator, the one who performed the Exodus. Psalm 47 calls the Lord Most High awesome, literally, to be feared, and a great king. The fear comes from recognizing his status and his saving works. Psalm 89 touches on this too.
And this isn't just an Old Testament thing, is it?
Not entirely. Think about the Mount of Transfiguration in Matthew 17. When the disciples hear God's voice from the cloud, what happens?
They fall on their faces, terrified.
Right. And Jesus has to tell them, rise and have no fear. He doesn't invalidate their initial terror in the face of that divine glory, but he comforts them. Psalm 66 talks about God's awesome deeds, how his enemies cringe before him, and how this leads to worship and praise. It connects fear with humility, contrasting it with rebelliousness. Proverbs 24 tells us to fear both the Lord and the King, acknowledging their authority and power. Psalm 76 says God is to be feared, striking terror in rulers.
And Psalm 2 is interesting too. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. That pairing seems significant.
It really is. It holds together the awe, the potential for wrath, kiss the Son, lest he be angry, but also the blessing for those who take refuge in him. It bookends the Psalter nicely with Psalm 1's focus on blessedness.
So this Mysterium Tremendum is a core part, but not the whole story. What about fear of punishment? That seems like a big one.
It is, and it's often where people get hung up, especially thinking about the New Testament. That verse in 1 John 4.18 always comes up. There is no fear in love. Perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment.
Right, so does that mean believers shouldn't fear God at all?
Well, context is crucial there. John seems to be talking specifically about the dread of condemnation, the fear of facing God's judgment as an enemy, or as someone outside his love. Perfect love, experienced through Christ, casts that kind of fear out. You're accepted, you're loved, you don't need to live in terror of punishment.
Okay, so it's addressing a specific kind of fear, the fear of judgment for those in Christ?
Exactly. It doesn't necessarily negate or erase all the other aspects of fear we're discussing, like awe, reverence, or even the healthy fear that motivates obedience, meaning depends heavily on context.
That makes sense. And the Old Testament certainly has examples of fear related to punishment.
Oh, definitely. Look at 1 Samuel 12. Samuel lays it out pretty clearly for Israel. Fear the Lord and serve him faithfully. Good things happen. Disobey. God's hand will be against you like it was against your fathers.
And then God sends that storm, the thunder and rain, right? And the text says the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel.
Yes. It was a direct consequence, a display of power tied to their sin, and it caused fear of further punishment. They even plead with Samuel, "Pray for your servants, that we may not die." They recognize the link between their actions and potential deadly consequences.
But even then, Samuel tells them, "Do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. Fear the Lord and serve him faithfully."
Right. So even in that context of fearing punishment, the call is still towards a fear expressed through faithful service. The fear of consequences is meant to drive them back to the right kind of fear, reverent obedience.
Are there other examples of just straight up fear of punishment?
Sure. Think of Adonijah in 1 Kings 1. He tries to usurp the throne from Solomon. When his plan fails, it says he was afraid of Solomon, and he ran and grabbed the horns of the altar, seeking sanctuary because he feared punishment.
Classic fear of consequences from a human authority in that case.
Yes, but the principle is similar. Or Nehemiah 2.2. Nehemiah is the king's cupbearer, and the king notices he looks sad, which was potentially dangerous in that role. Nehemiah admits, "I was very much afraid." He feared the king's displeasure and potential punishment.
Okay.
And then there's an interesting twist in Psalm 130, verse 4. It says, "But with you there is forgiveness, that you may be feared."
Wait, forgiveness leads to fear? That seems backwards.
It does at first glance. But the idea there seems to be that God's capacity for forgiveness, his willingness to not punish when he justly could, is itself awesome and awe-inspiring. It highlights his power and mercy in a way that evokes profound reverence, a kind of fear born from gratitude and recognition of his authority over life, death, judgment, and pardon.
That's a deeper layer, fear because he can forgive, not just because he can punish.
Exactly. It adds complexity.
Okay, so we've got sacred awe, fear of punishment. What about fear in relation to, like, religious duties? Cultic observance.
Yeah, that's another important facet, how fear connects to service, obedience, worship practices. 2 Kings 17 has a really fascinating kind of strange story about this.
Is that the one with the lions?
That's the one. New people are settled in Samaria by the Assyrians, but they don't worship Yahweh. They did not fear the Lord, the text says. So God sends lions among them.
Okay, that gets your attention.
Right. So the Assyrian king sends an Israelite priest back to teach them the justice, or the way, of the God of the land. And how does he teach them? It says he taught them how they should fear the Lord. And this teaching involved instructing them in God's statutes, ordinances, law, and commandment.
So learning the commandments was learning how to fear the Lord.
Exactly. The text even draws a parallel later, criticizing them because they feared the Lord but also served their own gods. The point is, in this context, fearing the Lord is directly equated with knowing and, ideally, keeping his specific laws and decrees. It's about proper observance.
That's very practical.
It is. We see echoes elsewhere, too. Ecclesiastes 5 advises, fear God, specifically in the context of not making rash vows or speaking foolishly in God's house. It connects fear with carefulness in religious speech and commitments.
Being mindful in worship.
And Malachi 2 talks about God's covenant with the priestly tribe of Levi. He calls it my covenant of life and peace, but then says, I gave them to him. It was a covenant of fear, and he feared me. He stood in awe of my name.
So fear and awe were part of the priestly covenant.
Yes, and it was linked directly to having true instruction in their mouths and turning people away from iniquity. Fear, in this priestly context, was tied to faithfulness in teaching and living God's law.
Okay, so observance, obedience to laws. What about just straightforward respect or reverence? Sometimes fear seems to mean something closer to that.
Absolutely. And the language itself sometimes gives us clues. In Leviticus 19, God commands the Israelites, keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. That word reverence comes from the same Hebrew root, yara, as the word usually translated fear.
Ah, so the same root word can mean intense fear or reverence, depending on the context.
Precisely. And in the context of the Sabbath and the sanctuary, it clearly means deep respect, holding them sacred, not cowering in terror. Leviticus 26 says the same thing.
Okay, that makes sense.
And think about the fifth commandment in Exodus 20. Honor your father and your mother. While it uses the word honor, kavod, the concept is closely related to respect and reverence that fear can imply in other contexts, like fearing the king or fearing God. It's about recognizing authority and showing proper respect.
So context is everything in figuring out the nuance between care, awe, obedience, and respect.
It really is. And another important aspect is that this fear of God, especially in the sense of reverence and obedience, is presented as something that can be taught.
Taught. How do you teach fear?
Well, look at Psalm 34. The psalmist says, "Come, O children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord." What does the teaching involve? Keep your tongue from evil. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it.
So, teaching the fear of the Lord is teaching practical righteousness and wisdom, how to live rightly.
Exactly. It's instruction in godly living. Deuteronomy 6 makes this connection crystal clear. Moses is teaching the commandments, statutes, and rules that you may fear the Lord your God by keeping all his statutes. And why? That your days may be long and that it may go well with you. It's taught for their benefit.
It's linked to well-being.
Yes. And Deuteronomy 10 asks that rhetorical question, what does the Lord your God require of you? And the first answer is to fear the Lord your God, which is then immediately explained as to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments.
So fearing God is walking in his ways, loving him, serving him, keeping the commandments. They're all bound up together.
They define each other in that context. Deuteronomy 31 talks about gathering everyone, men, women, children, foreigners, to hear the law so they can learn to fear the Lord your God by being careful to do all the words of this law. Even children need to learn it.
It's a foundational part of knowing and relating to God according to the covenant.
It is. Look at Psalm 19. It lists God's perfect law, his sure testimony, his right precepts, his pure commandment. And right alongside them, it says, the fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. It's presented as part of God's divine instruction, parallel to the law itself.
Wow. It's treated like law.
In a way, yes. Which makes Isaiah 29's critique even sharper. God complains about people who draw near with their mouths, but their hearts are far off, and their fear of me is a commandment taught by men.
Contrasting genuine heart-level fear with just like human rules learned by rote.
Exactly. A superficial learned tradition versus a deep internal reality. And of course, there's the famous conclusion of Ecclesiastes. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man.
That sums it up pretty powerfully. Fear and obedience are inseparable.
They really are presented that way often. This leads directly into understanding fear of God, simply as obedience in many contexts. Parallelism in the Psalms often shows this. Psalm 119.63, I am a companion of all who fear you and of those who keep your precepts. Fearing and keeping are set side by side.
Synonymous ideas in that poetic structure.
Right. Or Psalm 128.1, blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. Again, fearing equals walking in his ways.
Okay.
And remember Tesis Samuel 23 describing the ideal ruler. He rules justly, ruling in the fear of God. That's clearly a metonymy. Ruling in the fear of God means ruling according to God's principles, obeying his standards for justice.
Right. Not ruling while feeling scared.
No. And maybe the most powerful example is the Akedah, the binding of Isaac in Genesis 22. After Abraham shows he's willing to obey God's horrifying command, the angel says, "Do not lay your hand on the boy, for now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son."
So in that ultimate test, fearing God was demonstrated purely by Abraham's radical obedience.
Exactly. His action proved his fear. Obedience was the visible expression of his fear of God.
Okay, that's a crucial link. Now, what about those God-fearers you mentioned earlier? How does fear of God apply to them, to foreigners?
That's interesting because it seems to broaden the meaning sometimes to just basic morality or recognizing a divine accountability, even outside this specific covenant with Israel.
Like a general sense of right and wrong.
Kind of. Yeah. Think about Abraham in Genesis 20. He's in Gerar, Philistine territory, and he pretends Sarah is his sister because he thinks there is surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife.
So no fear of God meant to him a lack of basic moral restraint. They might just kill a stranger for his wife.
That seems to be his assumption. He equates fear of God with a fundamental moral compass that prevents outright wickedness. Later, King Abimelech is actually shown to be more moral than Abraham assumed, but Abraham's initial thought links fear of God with basic ethics. And maybe even clearer is Joseph in Genesis 42. He's testing his brothers in Egypt. They don't recognize him. He puts them in prison, then releases most of them, saying, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God."
What does he mean there? I fear God, so I'll let you go.
It seems to mean, because I fear God, I am a moral, just person. I won't abuse my power or treat you cruelly and unjustly without cause. You can trust me to act ethically because I recognize God's authority.
It's a statement about his character rooted in his relationship with God.
So for both Abraham and Joseph in these interactions with foreigners, fear of God signifies a baseline morality and trustworthiness.
It seems to function that way, yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes it just means simple piety or devotion. Like Obadiah in 1 Kings 18, it says he feared the Lord greatly.
And how did he show it?
By risking his life during Jezebel's persecution to hide and feed 100 of God's prophets. His great fear translated into courageous, faithful action. It was practical piety.
So fear as piety, and it's also presented clearly as a virtue, right? Like a core character trait. Definitely. Job is the prime example. Right at the start, Job 1 describes him. Blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. Fear of God is listed as one of his key virtues alongside integrity and avoiding evil.
And Satan picks up on that, doesn't he? Does Job fear God for no reason?
Exactly. Satan challenges the motive behind Job's fear, suggesting it's just because God blesses him. This highlights how central fearing God was seen to Job's righteous character.
It's the crux of the argument.
It is. And later, in Job 6, Job's friend Eliphaz implies, in some translations like NRSV, that Job, by speaking rashly, is bordering on forsaking the fear of the Almighty, suggesting that proper fear involves right speech and perhaps even how you treat friends in distress. It connects fear to moral conduct again.
So it's a foundational virtue, and this connects strongly to wisdom, doesn't it? That seems to be a major theme, especially in the wisdom literature.
Oh, absolutely central. Job 28, after that long poem searching for wisdom's source, concludes, "And he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding."
So fear of the Lord is wisdom. They're equated.
Directly equated there. And Psalm 11, point 10 famously states, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. All who practice it have good understanding." Proverbs repeats this idea multiple times.
The beginning of wisdom. What does beginning mean there? Like step one, or the most important part?
Good question. Commentators suggest it can mean all of those things. It could be the first step in time you start with fearing God. It could be the foundational principle, the underlying basis of all true wisdom. Or it can mean the best part, the principal element of wisdom. Probably all are implied.
It's fundamental however you slice it.
It is. Proverbs 1.7 says it's the beginning of knowledge. Proverbs 9.0 repeats it's the beginning of wisdom. It actually frames the first major section of Proverbs.
Oh, structurally important, too.
Very. It appears right at the start of the book, near the end of that first block of instruction, and then again, significantly, right near the end of the entire book, describing the woman who fears the Lord in Proverbs 31. She is the one to be praised. It brackets the whole collection in a way.
Wow. Yeah. And how else is it linked to wisdom in Proverbs?
Well, Proverbs 2 says, "If you seek wisdom like silver, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God." Seeking wisdom leads you to the fear of God. They're intertwined.
Okay.
Proverbs 8 has wisdom personified speaking. And she says, "I, wisdom, dwell with prudence." And then just a verse later, "The fear of the Lord is hatred of evil, pride and arrogance, and the way of evil and perverted speech I hate."
So wisdom hates evil, and the fear of the Lord is hatred of evil. They are deeply connected, and pride gets in the way.
Exactly. Pride is the opposite of the humility that often accompanies the fear of the Lord. Proverbs 3 urges, "Trust in the Lord. Lean not on your own understanding. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil." Trust, humility, fear, and turning from evil are all linked.
It leads away from self-reliance towards God-reliance.
Perfectly put. And Proverbs 15.33 says, "The fear of the Lord is instruction in wisdom, and humility comes before honor." Again, fear teaches wisdom, and it's linked to humility.
This virtue aspect seems really prominent in Proverbs.
It really is.
Yeah.
Proverbs 13.13 says, "Whoever fears the commandment, obeys it, will be rewarded." Proverbs 14 talks about the fear of the Lord bringing strong confidence and being a fountain of life.
Confidence. That seems counterintuitive to fear.
Right, but it's confidence in God.
Yeah.
A security that comes from being rightly related to him, from reverence and obedience. It's a refuge, especially contrasted with the fear of man later in Proverbs 29, which lays a snare.
Ah, so fear of God replaces fear of man and brings safety and confidence.
That's the idea. Proverbs 10 says the fear of the Lord prolongs life, parallel to how the years of the wicked are short. Proverbs 14 says simply, "Whoever walks in uprightness fears the Lord."
Mm.
It's just equated with righteous living.
It covers so much ground. Awe, obedience, morality, piety, wisdom, virtue.
It really does. And interestingly, it even shows up in the description of the ideal king, the Messiah, in Isaiah 11.
Oh, how so?
The Spirit of the Lord rests on him, bringing wisdom, understanding, counsel, might, knowledge, and the fear of the Lord. And it says his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord.
So even the perfect king delights in fearing God.
Yes, and that fear leads him to judge righteously, especially for the poor. It's part of his perfect character and reign.
And we saw Proverbs 24 connecting fear of the Lord and fear of the king, acknowledging both authorities.
Right. And Proverbs 29 contrasting this snare of fearing man with the safety of trusting in implicitly fearing the Lord.
Now, when Proverbs links fear of God to good outcomes like long life or confidence, we need to be careful not to read those as simple guarantees, right? Proverbs aren't promises in that mechanical way.
That's a really crucial point.
Yeah.
Proverbs describe general principles, the usual pattern of how character leads to consequences in a world governed by a wise God. They express what tends to happen, what wisdom generally looks like.
So fearing God and acting wisely usually leads to a better life, but it's not like a vending machine where you put in fear and always get out prosperity.
Exactly. Job's story itself shows that. But Proverbs operates on the principle that aligning yourself with God's wisdom, which includes fearing him, is the best path. And ultimately, as other Proverbs remind us, like 16.9, the heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps, or 21.3031, no wisdom, no understanding, no counsel can avail against the Lord. Victory belongs to the Lord. It's God who is sovereign over the outcomes.
Which brings us back to needing to fear him, the one actually in control, rather than just relying on a system or our own wisdom.
Precisely. That understanding of God's sovereignty reinforces why the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Okay, so we've unpacked a lot of different meanings or facets. How do we pull this all together? You mentioned metaphonomy earlier, based on the source material.
Right, metaphotonomy, that blend of metaphor and metonymy. Dr. Hildebrandt's insight, drawing on cognitive linguistics, is that the overarching metaphor providing the framework here is God as the divine king.
God as king, okay.
And within that metaphorical framework of God's kingship, the various meanings of fear of God function as metonymies, each highlighting a different aspect of how subjects relate to their king, or how we relate to God as king.
I see. So the different facets of fear correspond to different roles or aspects of a king.
Exactly. Let's map it out.
Okay.
The king performs mighty, awe-inspiring acts, displays his power and glory. Think theophanies, miracles like the Red Sea. Hmm. The response, sacred fear, awe, trembling, mysterium, tremendum.
Makes sense. Subjects are awed by a great king's power.
Right. The king is also the supreme judge, the distributor of justice. He punishes wrongdoing. The response, fear of punishment.
Okay, fear of the king's justice.
The king is the rightful object of honor, loyalty, and worship in his court. The response, reverence, worship, cultic service.
Paying homage to the king. Yeah.
The king issues laws, decrees, statutes for the kingdom. The response, obedience to those laws. Fearing God means keeping his commandments.
Following the king's law. Got it.
The king is ideally the source of wisdom and justice, the model for righteous living in the kingdom. The response, virtue developing godly character, hating evil, seeking wisdom, living righteously. Fear becomes synonymous with wisdom and virtue.
Emulating the king's character.
And the king rules over everyone in his domain. Even foreigners passing through are accountable to his basic standards of order and morality. The response, that general morality expected even of God-fearers.
Okay, so the kingship metaphor provides the big picture. And the different kinds of fear are metonymic ways we talk about responding to the different aspects of that kingship.
That's the idea. It helps us see how these diverse meanings aren't random, but are coherently linked within this powerful biblical metaphor of God as king. It's a really elegant way to understand the richness of the concept.
It really is. But, you know, just defining it isn't quite enough, is it? I think it was A.W. Tozer who said something like, it's not enough to define a theological concept. You need to know its meaning and experience its reality in life.
That's a profound point. It has to move beyond the academic.
Yeah. And for me personally, I think I really grasped a deeper dimension of what fear of God could mean when my son was deployed in Afghanistan.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
As a father feeling completely, utterly helpless to protect him from the dangers he was facing. It was this incredibly intense experience. There was nothing I could do from thousands of miles away.
I can only imagine that sense of vulnerability.
Exactly. And it forced me to this place of really deep humility, just a stark realization that ultimately only God had control over his safety. My control was zero. Mm. And that intense vulnerability, that recognition of my own limits and God's absolute sovereignty, it led to this profound dependence on him, a much deeper sense of trust, frankly. In that specific context, fear wasn't just terror, though there was anxiety, of course. It was more this overwhelming sense of awe at God's power over life and death, mixed with this deep need for his mercy and protection. It drove me to prayer, to worship, in a way that felt much less theoretical.
That's a powerful story. And it illustrates perfectly how these different facets can converge in real life, doesn't it? The situation evokes helplessness, maybe even a kind of dread, which leads to humility, a recognition of God's sovereignty, awe, which fosters dependence and trust, and ultimately shapes how you pray, obey, worship. It connects the dots.
Yeah, it felt like many of those aspects we discuss, awe, dependence, humility, trust, leading to prayer and worship, they all kind of coalesced in that experience.
It shows the importance of recognizing all these interconnected meanings while still appreciating their distinct nuances, depending on the biblical text or the life situation.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, drawing on your source material from Dr. Hildebrandt, the main takeaway is that fear of God is incredibly rich. It's not just one thing.
Not at all.
It spans this whole range from terror and awe to reverence, obedience, wisdom, virtue, morality, all connected, as we saw, through that lens of metonymy working within the bigger metaphor of God's kingship.
It's a concept that really rewards deeper reflection.
Definitely. And maybe here's a final thought for our listeners to mull over. How might understanding these different dimensions of the fear of God reshape your own understanding of your relationship with the divine? How might it change your perspective on your own sense of control versus dependence when you face challenges in your life?
That's a great question to ponder. Maybe think about which aspect of the fear of God resonates most strongly with you right now in your current circumstances, and perhaps explore why that might be the case. It could be revealing.